Psalm 3. Titled Psalm 3 and the message based on it, Hope and Despair. I'll tell you up front that I don't really like the title, but I don't know what else to call it, and I didn't know else how to title it, and I almost just didn't at all, because it fits, certainly, but there's so much more. And I'm afraid that if you fixate on just this one aspect of what's included in the psalm, then you'll miss the other things that are equally important. So that when you see someone going through a period of despair, crying out to God, receiving the help and support of Him, we think, what a wonderful thing that God helped this poor person. And that's true. It's absolutely true. But what a wonderful thing that we have a God who can help the poor person. What a wonderful thing that we have a God who is engaged in the midst of the things that cause us despair. What a wonderful thing that we have someone who recognized his inability and said, Lord, I'm at your disposal. Was it the despair that brought him to that moment? Maybe. But whatever it was, in the midst of all of this, there's so much more than just figuring out how to get through your hard times. I wouldn't diminish them at all, and I don't mean in any way what I'm saying to minimize your pain. Please know that that is not my purpose. But beyond your pain, I want you to know that there is hope and there is power. And there is a cause for praise that extends through and beyond all of that. So that what the psalmist does for us is help us to understand that and to see it in all of its glory. So Psalm 3, it says, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son. So the title is part of the text. And there's no reason to doubt its authenticity. And it's telling us that he wrote this psalm while he was in exile, during a period of time that one of his sons, named Absalom, had come into Jerusalem and over a period of a few years had gathered support to overthrow his kingdom. And when he had enough support, he went to Hebron and had the people there declare him king. Then he took the army, went to Jerusalem to kill David and drive him from the throne. David fled before Absalom could arrive, and he went to the other side of the Jordan and he hid out in a cave and in tents while he got together his forces that still remained loyal to him and tried to decide what to do. A civil war is basically what is raging in Israel during this time. And King David is exiled from his throne, and his throne is now occupied by one of his sons, Absalom. This is just as it is not appropriate that we would get caught up in the focus on despair and miss the glory and sovereignty of God, it is also not appropriate that we get caught up in the historical background of this and miss its current application. There's really no way for you to relate to what David was going through unless you've been king somewhere and you've had that kingdom ripped from you by a son that was ungrateful. That's really a pretty unique set of circumstances that's hard to really identify with. We can identify with family trauma. We can identify with broken relationships. We can identify with sinful activity that leads to dysfunction. And all of those things were certainly present in David's life and in his family. But the bottom line is that in the midst of something that was personally, nationally, spiritually, governmentally, in a state of complete upheaval, in the midst of all of that, David sat alone and sought God, and this is how he responded to him. This is the encounter between David and God during this time of great difficulty. Hope and despair, then, in Psalm 3, begins in verses 1 and 2. It says the Psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son, "O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation for him in God." The statements that you see here are statements that are reminding us of the pain that occurs during times of distress. So the pain of distress is something that helps us to identify all of us. It doesn't matter what the distress is. It doesn't matter whether it compares to his or not. All of us experience this pain and the confusion and the sense of isolation and distance and all the things that go with it. And so David gives voice to his pain by beginning with, "O Lord." He uses the covenant name for God, which is Yahweh. And so we see it throughout the Old Testament. It's generally translated Lord, and it's something that has a tone or ring to it of almost, a liturgical distance, for lack of a better way to describe it. So that when we say, "O Lord," it has almost a feeling of formality that is associated in a way that causes us to miss what's going on here. Do you remember in the New Testament when Jesus spoke to God and he also helped us to understand how we are to pray and how we talk to God? He used a term that you may recognize, Abba. Abba, Father. It is a term of endearment and it is a term of intimacy. So that when we hear that, it isn't something that we would also think of along the lines of, "O Lord." We would think of this as something far more personal and more intimate. And when you read, "O Lord," here, I want you to think, "Abba, Father." I want you to think of those intimate descriptions that we have of someone that we recognize as Father, or a father figure, but we do so in terms of the deepest emotional endearment, but also confidence that flows from that very familiar relationship. This is what David did. So he speaks out of his intimate relationship with God, and he says, "How many are my foes, and how many are rising against me?" Lots of enemies. Lots of enemies. How many enemies? Well, I don't know exactly, and the Bible doesn't specify. Books of Samuel give us a lot of information about these incidents, and you can read them. We know this. We do know that when David finally gets his forces together in order to reclaim the throne, that his army will go out and fight against Absalom and his army, and David's army will kill 20,000 soldiers. Now, how many more will be wounded? No way to calculate that, but the Bible declares that 20,000 died. So when he says, "O Lord, how many are my enemies?" He isn't asking for a number. He is saying there are so many against me that it's hard for me to even fathom. They are more numerous than I can count. And they are overwhelming. It is impossible for me to imagine victory in the midst of this scenario. And how often have we felt that the enemy is so far and so vastly arrayed against us that whatever is before us seems insurmountable. And it seems impossible to envision a victory ultimately coming out of such opposition. It's important for us to realize that the problems of life and the difficulties that we face are inspired by the evil that so often dominates the culture around us and the world that we are a part of, and even the brokenness that is within us. So that we see our enemy, the evil one, as the one who seeks to lead us astray, to undo that which Christ has placed in us, to try and disrupt the flow of the Spirit in the life of the believer in whatever way is possible, so that the effectiveness of your life is diminished for the glory of God and the kingdom purpose for which He has called you. David says that these enemies are overwhelming. They are rising against me. There is a force that is coming to get me, and I know it. In verse 2, he says, many are saying of my soul, there's no salvation for him from God. In addition to David being at a point of greatest risk that he's ever faced in all of his life, physically, he is also being faced with the disillusion of his character and his relationship with God. So that what Absalom has done is spread the word that the reason that he was able to become king and to take the throne from David, and the reason that David fled, was because God had withdrawn his promise from him and his blessing. Now, David certainly didn't do anything at times to endear himself to God. And while God blessed him richly and greatly, we see in David's life, especially in the early phase of it, the very high standard of excellence and ethics that he lives by. That continues until the time that he succumbs to temptation and he has an adulterous relationship with Bathsheba and his world begins to crumble and his family along with it. David had made mistakes prior to that, but this one was of devastating consequence. And much of what we see happening in the relationship between him and Absalom is directly tied to David's sin. So that he not only is feeling the crushing weight of opposition, he is now questioning his spiritual viability and whether or not God's blessing remains on him. Now let me tell you something. When God says it, that's it. You say, well, it's conditional upon me believing it, and it's conditional upon me doing something in response to it. I want you to be really careful with putting conditions on God. I'm not telling you that there aren't circumstances where we have responsibility in response to God. We certainly do. What I'm telling you is that the purpose, the plan, the power to get it done has never been in you or with you. If that is true, then any spiritual achievement or advancement you make, you can take credit for, and that's never right. That's never right. You can take joy in that. You can have the sense of peace and the satisfaction that comes from knowing that you are walking according to the purpose of God. But the glory for that and the gratitude for that must be to God. He is the one that enables in us that which He has called us to. So David is at a moment where he is hearing this message that has been trending for some time in Israel, that God has withdrawn his blessing from him. But God told him he would not only ensure that an heir of his would sit on the throne, but from that heir and from the lineage of David would come the king, the Messiah. Think about it in terms of our current circumstances when we face hardships and difficulty and pain, when we deal with the reality that we live with a force that is always opposed to us and against us, that is conniving behind our backs and even sometimes directly in front of our faces in order to unseat that which God has placed in us. And then all of this comes kind of crushing in on us and we start to doubt and wonder whether or not God is real, whether or not God is present, whether or not God is able. David was at that very moment hearing the voices outside who were saying that no longer was the Lord's hand upon him and no longer was God going to care for him. I want you to know that if you are facing those difficult times, if you are in the midst of that despair, if you are dealing with the pain that is associated with such loss and distress, I want you to know that what God has promised has not in any wise been taken back. God says it. God does it. And maybe the reason it's hard for us to trust God in the midst of the circumstances of life, especially those that cause us distress, is because what we really wanted was a God who would make life easy. And when that doesn't happen, then we don't want God at all. And I'm sorry if someone told you that that's who God is and you believed it. But you should be happy to know that now you have the opportunity to receive truth. You see, we live as broken people in the midst of people who are broken in a world that is utterly and eternally broken. And it will remain that way until Jesus comes again and makes it right. But it is in this world that is broken that God has said, I will give you redemption and help. I will never leave you or forsake you. That my grace will be sufficient for your every need. And he has called us his children, adopting us into his own family. None of that ever goes away, and none of that can be changed by circumstantial issues. So maybe the reason that you're not embracing the hope that God is offering you in your time of despair is because your expectations of God are skewed from what they should be. This is your chance to put that right. And in the midst of that, you will discover that the pain of distress can lead to an awareness that you couldn't have imagined before. Verse 3 says, But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. In the midst of the pain of distress, what do we find? We find the presence of God. David describes God and goes with what he knows rather than what he is currently feeling. He lets his truth dictate his next step rather than his emotions. And he says, You, O Lord, are a shield about me. He reminds himself of who God is and who God has shown himself to be over all of these years. So he describes him as a shield, and in so doing, he is putting us into the battle with him. So we see ourselves as being shielded from the battle that is raging around us. And God is providing a shield that is just not a forecovering, but it is one that completely encircles. That's why he says, about me. And so I am completely protected as I go through. Does it mean that he is not still in the battle? It doesn't mean that. Does it mean that the battle isn't raging around him? It doesn't mean that. In fact, quite the opposite. In the midst of the battle, in the midst of the trial, in the midst of the threat, is where we discover the strength of God. He said, You are a shield about me, my glory. There's some discussion about the translation of this and whether or not he's talking about my understanding of God's glory or his own glory. I want you to see it as a personal statement, and I think the way it's translated as I'm reading it to you is exactly the way it should be, because he also says the lifter of my head. So it's a very personal, possessive statement that is designed to show us, again, the level of intimacy that exists. You are a shield about me. You are my glory. You are the reason why I have a connection to that which is eternal. You are the reason why that I have hope in the midst of this despair. You are the reason why that even if they kill me, they cannot have me. You're my glory. You see, glory is in the awareness of the power of God and the presence of God and the love of God. Glory doesn't come from personal achievement. It doesn't come from the praise of others. It doesn't come from even overwhelming an enemy or defeating someone who opposes. Glory comes from the greater awareness of something that is beyond ourselves that connects us to God. And he says, You are my glory. You are the reason that I have that connection. You are the reason that I have that hope. You are the reason that I have this relationship. Remember, God called David and made him king. God anointed David. God gave David his spirit. Everything that David had experienced that had elevated his life in order to lead his people and to be the man who would establish a lineage that ultimately from which the Messiah would be born, everything came from God. You are my glory. Everything that you and I have as hope today is dependent not on who we are and what we have done, But all of the things that are a part of our lives have come about as a result of Him. He is our glory. And the lifter of my head, He says. No more downcast. Look up. Elsewhere the psalmist will say, look up unto the hills from whence cometh my strength. It comes from the Lord. So here we see some of that. He is the lifter of our heads. Got your head down? Staring at the ground? Walking down the hall looking at your phone so you can avoid contact with the other people that are passing you along the way? It's time to look up. It's time to look around. He's the lifter of my head. And so doing what He is giving David is a vision of what is around him, a vision of what is true. He's letting him see God for who He really is. As a result now, instead of the pain of distress, the presence of God leads him to a sense of peace. Look at verse 5. I lay down and slept. I woke again, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of many thousands of people who have set themselves against me all around. The peace of God. So what did he do? He went to sleep. Distress and despair is exhausting, isn't it? It drains the life out of us. Depression drains the will of its ability to move forward so that we find ourselves almost paralyzed. We know in our minds what we need to do, but we don't have, it seems, the strength to do it. And so there is this draining effect that takes place. Knowing truth isn't enough to provide energy. Still, you are a physical being, and so you need rest. He laid down and he slept. He was renewed. It doesn't say how long he slept, but I'm sure he slept for a while. And he said, I woke again because the Lord had sustained him. And so in the midst of this rest, in the midst of this peace, David was restored physically, but then that also gave him restoration emotionally and spiritually and mentally. You see, there aren't parts of you that are individually separated out that you can address apart from one another, but it all connects together. So if the physical part of you is diminished, that's going to have an effect on your ability emotionally and mentally to cope as well. And so all of these things are necessary. What I'm telling you is eat your vegetables and go to bed on time. That's what I'm telling you. All of these things are connected. They're all a part of who God has made us to be. It's not a limitation, it is an opportunity, and it's a reality. And so God calls us, and God enables us, and as a result of that, God was now giving him peace so that he could be restored. He said when he woke, I will not be afraid, even though there are thousands who have set themselves against me and are all around me. And that was exactly the case. So the peace of God sustained him in the midst of the uncertainties of the world around him. So that in verse 7 we see the power of God on display. Arise, O Lord, and save me, O my God. For you strike all my enemies on the cheek and you break the teeth of the wicked. And so now he seeks the power of God. The power of God is something that is going to be on display. But notice the very specific way that he requests it. He says arise, meaning coming up in a way that is visible, so that God is on display and the ability of God can be seen, such as it has been in times past, as the armies of God, although outnumbered, sometimes dramatically so, marched against overwhelming forces and defeated them, seemingly with ease, giving rise to the understanding of all who observed and came to know that the victory belongs to the Lord. He said, arise. And then he says, strike them on the cheek. It means punch them in the head. It means what it says. It means to knock them out. It's a physical description. It's something that is associated with this desire to overcome this enemy. But notice he's not saying, give me the ability to knock them out. He says, you knock them out. There's a difference. One leads to vengeance, the other to genuine victory. Trusting God for victory, having faith in God for victory, is different than asking God to make you victorious. There is a difference, and it requires our consideration, because it is a distinction that can determine whether or not God is glorified or you are. And God must be the one who's glorified. He says, break their teeth. And here it is different. He's talking about the teeth of the wicked in a way that he would also talk about a wild animal that is a predator. And so what is the power of that animal? It lies in the teeth that pose the greatest threat. And so he says, break the teeth of the wicked and they can't bite me. They can't kill me. So not only is God's ability and power to overcome the thousands arrayed against him, but it is also to disarm the predatory threats that are seeking to destroy him. So with his declaration of the power of God, then comes a settled sense of confidence that leads to the praise of God. The pain of distress, the presence of God, the peace of God, the power of God. Fifth, the praise of God. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be on your people. Salvation belongs to the Lord. That's a really strong statement that we need to hear. A little insight, not another story, just insight. Years ago, I decided that I would not give an invitation at the end of the services anymore. I told you then why. I'll remind you what I said then. Invitations lead to emotional decisions, and sometimes decisions that are short-sighted, so that what we saw, not only in our church, but convention-wide through the Southern Baptist Convention, with people coming forward during invitations, making decisions, but without any follow-up. And the reason was because in the midst of that emotional upheaval that sometimes is associated with either guilt or something else, there would be this cathartic release that would take place as a person would come forward and maybe in despair would pour out their heart, and they would receive prayer and the support of the congregation. And then it was like everything was okay and go their way. Sometimes we would see people that would make decisions, even follow up maybe with baptism a week or two later, and then never come back to church. We have name after name after name that fit that pattern. And what was happening was there was a strong emphasis on a momentary decision, but there was very little emphasis on genuine biblical discipleship. And I didn't know how to fix it. So I just stopped. Now, over the number of years, it was speculated that we would see a decline in the number of baptisms and the number of people joining the church, and that has not happened. In fact, there have been a couple of years where we've actually seen increases from what we had before when we did invitations. But I'm still concerned. I still feel like there needs to be something. When we gather together and we read a passage like this and you hear a message that God uses to stir your heart and direct you to something in your life, I think there needs to be a time for us to deal with that. And so a few weeks ago, I spoke to your other pastors and said, we need to figure out how to do this. We haven't figured it out yet, but we're going to. Or we're going to try something and see if it works, and then if it doesn't, we'll try something else. What I'm telling you is this. I'm telling you that in the midst of the circumstances of life, when we trust God and when we experience God and when we then go on and we experience the praise of God, that that needs to be something that directs our attention to Him. The way we've done things in the past that focuses only on our problems or only on our cathartic release or only on our guilt, that's about us. There's no praise for God in that. But when we can come to a time of settled conclusion where we can acknowledge the victory of God and we can understand the grace of God and we can see and experience together the joy associated with the deliverance of God, then we can join together in a meaningful life of praise to God so that what happens is in fact discipleship that is moving us from where we were through what we've known into what we are becoming. That's what we see here. His praise was evidence of transformation. And transformation is discipleship. You can go forward during an invitation and you can weep and cry and wail over your sin. And you can get up and walk out and be absolutely 100% unchanged. If nothing changes in the way you conduct your life, in the way you live in relationship to others, and in the calling to which God has given you and also is leading you, there's no transformation in that. And without transformation, there is no discipleship. It's no different than you driving your dirty car through the car wash. It's clean for a while, but the rain's coming. And after all, we all live on gravel roads, don't we? Spiritually speaking, we all live on gravel roads. And that means that every new day brings what? Another layer of dirt. It's either dusty or it's muddy, but either way, it's dirty. The only way that you and I become who God has called us to be is to realize that He is in the process of changing us. That's what David meant when he said, "You are my salvation. You are the means by which I have come to understand the transformation. You've changed me. You've made me something that I could never have made of myself. And you are still doing that in the midst of my distress, even as thousands are arrayed against me." All of that isn't a declaration of the confidence of David or the faith of David or the hope of David. It is a declaration of the power and praise of God. Faith and hope and confidence in life and circumstances, those come from not fixating on the circumstances or ourselves, but on God. And that's what David did. So, our hope in despair is found in the salvation that belongs to the Lord, knowing that not only will He change us, but He will be a blessing on all people. What a great promise and what a great hope that God is calling us to. I pray that as He works in your heart, in your mind, that what you experience today doesn't remain here. Let it go with you. Let it change you.